Welcome, Dr. Lim, to
welcome, Dr. Lou,
to the pod. And today we were going to cover a contentious topic. We're gonna get into a fight about states' rights and the individual rights. And I believe that your position was that the state should own everything. So
yeah,
tell me about your communism.
Okay, so I mean, well, look, it's not full communism, really. We need to make a distinction between capitalism, socialism, and communism, first and foremost. So capitalism is kind of like, free trade market kind of deal. It's people who get to own whatever they like to own, and when they own it, they get to decide what to do with it. In a nutshell, I'm going to get, cancelled by a lot of capitalists there, but I think that's kind of the basic idea. Communism is that nobody owns anything, in a nutshell, nobody owns anything, and, everybody is everybody. Ownership of things like property and goods and services and things like that is owned by everybody, and then, technically, it becomes owned by the state, and people own the state, all that sort of thing. Socialism in the middle, I think, is where I kind of want to rest on here maybe a little bit and say, I want to talk about capital goods and say no individual should be able to own capital goods, should be owned by the state. You can own toothbrushes and books and shares and stuff, but you can't own factories and farms and jazz like that.
So out of clarity, what would you define as a capital good?
Capital good. Okay, so a capital good, off the top of my head, is a good that can produce other goods. It's a good that has an impact on more than one individual. So it's like has a social impact. But for the most part, it definitely produces things. It makes other goods or services.
So would you count a house as a capital good?
Ooh. No, I suppose not, unless that house were to produce something else, like smaller houses or carpet or something.
I mean, suppose I want to produce rent from people. Does that count? If I want to own a share house and I want to bring in boarders to come in and provide this very valuable service of my space, Then isn't that a capital good?
Look, I'm going to say on the face of it, no, because you're dealing with purely like exchange of capital. We're not talking about goods and services here necessarily. I mean, you're talking about service. You know what? Maybe you've changed my mind. Maybe a house is a capital good in that it can produce the service of living. Yeah, you've done it. Yes, I count the houses now as capital goods.
All right.
See how easily I'm persuaded?
Well, you know what? Intellectually humble position of being able to change our minds at least partway through.
Absolutely.
So the question is, why should the state own all the capital goods?
Okay. Why should the state own all capital goods? I think, we can look at this in terms of equality. We can look in terms of equity. But if we take the idea of, well, what is the state doing? Why do we have a state or government or bloc? And the idea is, one idea is to get out of Hobbes's state of nature. And, state of nature is a bad place where everyone's killing everybody else and nobody gets ahead. When we decide as a group or community to pool our resources and agree upon certain rules that do, yes, limit some of our freedoms, then we all benefit from it. And that should extend, I think, to anything that has any sort of impact on more than one person, namely capital goods. That all sounded right. really reasonable, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So does that mean that we're going with like a Hobbesian state of nature here? It's dog eat dog without the law, and humans will not cooperate unless there is a direct benefit for it.
For simplicity's sake, let's say yes. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
Now, what about my freedom? What about my choice? What if I have aspirations for humanity, my own designs to bring about, and I can't do that while operating under these constraints? I can't build a rocket repair station and take us to space. I can't be Elon Musk. If I'm not allowed to own the capital good because the state Well, you know, it might eventually take us to space, but I don't see Australian Space Command existing for another 100 years.
Well, look, Dr. Luke, I have to just, I mean, highlight the kind of capitalist bourgeoisiness of this position, really, in that, you know, you're arguing for a particular value, namely freedom, as like the be all and end all of kind of social good, but freedom qua freedom, freedom in its perfect state is chaos. If we have the freedom to do anything anywhere, then we don't have a community, we have an anarchy, we have no rule at all. If I were to say to you, you don't have the freedom to kill your next door neighbor, are you okay with that?
I mean, I'm forced to say yes, because I also like valuing my own freedom to live.
Okay, so we're okay with restricting some freedoms. So you're okay with this idea. It's just a name of quantity now. How much freedom can you or are you willing to restrict in order to have a good life? Now, my second point on your Elon Musk kind of thing, you know, we can shift that slightly into a more practical scenario of Jeff Bezos, who actually went to space. But if we see in that scenario, Jeff Bezos went to space and maybe four or five other people, I don't see me going into space anytime soon. And so it's like, you know, very, very wealthy and elite people being benefiting from this so-called freedom. But most people, we're not going to see the benefits of commercial space travel for another 100 or 200 years, if that.
Yeah, but haven't they earned the right to go to space compared to the rest of us who aren't providing the same economic goods as Jeff Bezos?
Hell no. No, not at all. I staunchly want to make an argument that there is no way in hell that Jeff Bezos could possibly earn the amount of money that he has. There is no possible way to earn, how many billions does he have?
You mean like morally earn? Like
No. Like even economically, physically work. Like there's no kind of trade of goods and services that an individual can do to amass $1 billion. I think that is impossible. I think the way he has done it is by nefarious means.
Okay. I think this might be a falsifiable claim, though, because there are going to be billion-dollar companies that can trade $1 billion here and there. And, you know, oil is worth a lot of money. And I imagine if you trade in just high-value goods, like, you know, military craft and things like that. I mean, like, have you seen the costs of aircraft carriers? Those things go for quite a bit of money.
I reckon they're all about $250, and it's just like markup. but okay, I take your word for it. Like companies exchange in large amounts of money. Individuals don't. I suppose when we look at Jeff Bezos, what we're talking about is Amazon more than anything else, right? And we have this figurehead that is Jeff Bezos. And yet, even though we are talking about a company or corporation doing these things, which might be okay, it is still the very few individuals that appear to be benefiting from it, and not, say, the millions or at least thousands or tens of thousands of Amazon employees that are working underneath the Bezos.
The Bezos. So I want to look at, so you've had this implied premise here that unstructured freedom is essentially worthless, and that a concern that's equally, if not greater, of greater importance is equality and fairness and perhaps justice. Is that right?
I want to squeeze in equity in there, but sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So as a result, we shouldn't have, the government should control capital goods. So why the government?
Someone has to. Now, if we look at Hobbes' State of Nature, he's like, you know what? Any rule of law is better than no rule of law. So as long as we have an organization that has the rights of the people, the goods of the people in mind, I actually don't mind who it is. Right now, I'm calling it the government, but it might be, you know, it might be Telstra if they became benevolent.
So, but there's an implicit argument here as well that it should be democratic as well.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah.
I mean, if it's representing the people and
their... Okay, yeah, that's true. You're right. Okay, yeah, I guess I'm forced into democracy then.
Yeah. I mean, like, we could have an elected dictator like Naboo and Queen Amidala. And
I mean, you know, I like the idea of a dictator that everybody quite likes and is nice. You know, the monarchy that is actually good and loved by the people. But I mean, obviously, there's issues of corruption there.
Yeah, but I could see there's this angle of philosopher king coming in here.
Oh, sure. I mean, look. You know, if you want someone who is less corruptible than most, the Frodo of the 21st century, then you have to look at the philosopher, I think.
Okay, so we need a Frodo in chief. Oh, this is a good idea.
Yeah. All
right. But okay, so here's a additional question then. How do schools figure into this? Are schools capital goods? Are people still allowed to own schools? Or
oh hell no. No. I think schools would definitely fall under the purview of this organization that we're hopefully calling a government.
What about religious schools then?
See, I think we need to take the line that we've been talking about for the last several hundred years and say that there's a separation between church and state. And so maybe we don't have something like a religious school so much anymore. Religion as a subject, theology, I'm all for. But a school pushing a particular, you know, religious belief structure in a community that is made up of more than one religion seems iffy.
Now, I'm not going to...
For any, just on the side, for any future employers, please disregard everything I just said.
All right, I'm going to try to interpret this as charitably as I possibly can and not strawman it. But
sure.
We could foreseeably see the dissolution of a number of organized religions, just like Catholicism requires catechism, the religious teaching, and there are madrasas, you know, schools, religious schools that it's part of their own structure. So are we going to end up basically attacking organized religion through this pro-government stance?
Well, look, I mean, attacking is such a harsh word, but certainly not allowing to continue. How about that? Forcefully not allowing to continue if need be. I don't think that the government, the body, organization, body of a whole community should take stances in terms of religious belief. I think the principle of allowing belief to occur as a, you know, private enterprise, fine, but in the production of knowledge in the school, I don't think it should be permitted in this state.
Okay. All right. Here's a good example. Here's a good problem.
Mm-hmm.
What about movie makers and publishers and creative media types? Those are all arguably capital goods. But now we're going to have government control of writers and actors and directors.
So you're hitting my limits of my understanding of capital goods, but I'm going to go with you here and let's assume that these are capital goods. And I think maybe one good example might be, say, journalism, like the news media outlets. I can kind of see where you're going with this, I think. Because if they are capital goods, then yes, perhaps they should at very least be run by the governmental organization. I think we would have to accept that. Same with movies and potentially TV. You know, the ABC's all right. It just gets a bit more funding and, you know, 7, 10, and 9 slowly fade away. Or maybe we get ABC 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 instead of 10, 7, and 9, I guess.
But then how will I figure out who is on The Bachelor or who is Dancing with the Stars if reality TV dissolves, because there's actual funding now?
I mean, I don't know whether there's necessarily a dissolving of The Bachelor or of the Kitchen Nightmares or the renovations while also adopting a child and cooking a good meal while the president is coming to dinner. I think these shows can still exist, probably. because they would generate and seem to generate lots of capital for government enterprises. So I think that's fine. Like, I think as long as, like, we can still have these kind of semi-capitalist machinations happening, just as long as all this like proceeds and stuff is going into this governmental body and then filtering back out into the greater society.
Okay, so this is mostly about profits then. These organizations cannot really earn a profit. They're all non-for-profits then.
I mean, yeah, I'd agree to say that it's all about profit. Yeah. So I mean, that's the control of the capitalist world is the control of the profit, I suppose. So, you know, in turning to socialist, we U-turn all the profits going to private organizations and filter them into the public organization. Yeah.
I think I'm going to run up to against this problem where I have greed. I have greed in my soul. I am Ferengi-like. And I want to have a palatial mansion, and I want to have $1 billion and a media company, and I want to be able to have the poorest 250 Australians all put together in a room where they're forced to fight one another for my entertainment, and in a series of increasingly difficult challenges and games. Now, who are you to tell me that I can't do that?
Okay, first of all, I love the very nicely hidden Star Trek reference there. I was going to say Deep Space Nine, but Ferengi are all about the place. Okay, I suppose, on the face of it, in terms of freedom of choice or whatever, I have no right to say that. But if we're going to devalue freedoms in some sense, then freedom stops being something that you can use as a bargaining chip like this. You don't have the right to a palatial mansion. You don't have the right to tell a bunch of people in a house they have to do some weird set of games or else they get kicked out and they have to stay in their underpants the whole time. I think that's probably the point. I think this is less about a rights-based system. I think we, in a sense, we would lose some rights, but we would gain some, what are the other things?
Equity, equality, yeah, justice.
We would all benefit from less. Oh man, did I just say that? We would all benefit from less rights. But okay, on the face of it, the idea that freedom qua freedom is the only and most important value seems to lead to a Big Brother style existence. And I mean the show and the 1984 issue. And so a restriction of certain rights in that maybe I don't have the right to force hundreds of people to work for barely minimum wage so that I can buy a house with a slide that goes down to a pool underground. And maybe that's okay. Maybe that's what I'm saying, I suppose. Yeah.
I mean, it is an interesting problem, actually, because what is the value of freedom if, in a very practical sense, there are a lot of people who don't have it?
Yeah. Because I mean, it's rarity, right? It's rarity. Freedom is valuable because not everyone has it, yeah. Because it's rare.
I mean, absolute freedom is really only available if you have a large enough amount of money.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, I think when we get to this kind of stage, trying to be as serious as humanly possible about this, what I tend to see as the kind of capitalist approach is the vast majority of people trying to convince themselves that they will one day be the 1%, because the 1% is who kind of benefits from the capitalist system. And the possibility that anyone can get there is the second kind of major block in any capitalist system. So what we need is an exclusive elite, aristocracy, a royal family, divine, people or whatever, very wealthy. But capitalism breaks down those barriers of aristocracy and go, no, anyone can get there if you just insert blank here. You know, and sometimes people put in work really hard, which is a lie. Sometimes people get really lucky, which is probably accurate. And sometimes, people will put in be born into a rich family like the aristocracy, and that's how it goes.
I want to offer a an alternative interpretation of this, right? Which is that there are natural hierarchies to the world, and that we are born into privilege or into serfdom, and that is the way the world is intended to be by fate, by a higher power, and that going against that and in creating these attempts to change the nature of the world fundamentally goes against our karma, against what we're here to do.
Okay. What evidence do you have to suppose this, though?
Well, there is the complete consistency of this trend throughout all of history. I mean, if we had not this fate for ourselves, then surely some human group would have been able to find out and create a structure of it that worked in some fundamental way. Even the communists organized themselves into an aristocracy almost immediately. So, and they were supposed to be an egalitarian society.
So are you, correct me if I'm wrong here, are you suggesting that there is a naturalness to hierarchy, that there is a, you know, an inherent inescapableness to hierarchy amongst humans?
Yeah, and as time goes on, that hierarchy will stretch further in both directions, with the people at the top getting higher, you know, like literally Bezos leaving the atmosphere and transcending humanity, and the people at the bottom becoming an unintelligible slurry of suffering.
Because, a Moloch, basically.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Look, historically speaking, there appears to be lots of evidence for this, because rich people tend to stay rich, through families. Poor people tend to stay poor. We have outliers, though. Do these matter? The person who wins the lottery, or the dude that works hard and actually, you know, earns a lot of money because of their hard work. Very, very weird outliers. But, you know, do these disrupt this system, or is this built into it?
I mean, it would be a certain amount of self-maintenance within the system so that people still have hope, because people at the bottom don't want to feel like life isn't worth living. And if they have the carrot dangled in front of them that they could ascend past their current level and achieve greater levels of happiness, then they will continue to work for it. That's why there are lotto tickets, because it gives people false hope when they're stuck at the bottom.
All right. Here's an argument. Even if this is inherent, even if I allow that there is a natural human tendency to hierarchicalize, if that's a word, I would also argue that, according to Hobbes, there's a natural human tendency to rip each other's faces off and eat them. But that's why we have our government thing. That's why we escape the state of nature, because our natural state is this bad thing. And so to say that hierarchy is a natural state is not to say that we must follow it. It's just that if left unattended, this is what we become. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't work towards dismantling said hierarchy.
Yeah. Look, if I'm going to be honest with myself here, I'm getting an ought from an is. You know, the world is hierarchical, which assumes ought to be hierarchical. And there's no link between those things.
Absolutely. Very important terminology there. We often hit the is-ought distinction between various things.
Of the ethical systems that we have are based on where we want to end up morally as a people, and the hierarchy, we have no actual foundation for it. So I've got to be honest about that. I have one last question. How do we determine who gets what house?
I feel like we could set up a giant Monopoly board. Dice.
Well, are we playing Monopoly for it? Like,
I mean, ironically, maybe. But okay. Practically speaking, I don't know. Practically speaking, I think, how do we distribute goods? Like, how do we distribute wealth, like living conditions, in a place like where we are, where there's you know, big houses and little units and townhouses and open blocks, and there's shanties and there's shacks, and they're, you know, not all equidistant from each other and goods and services. What I would say is, I suppose if we had to deal with this world now, it would be messy. But if we had a chance to, you know, wipe the slate clean and build fresh, then we could potentially design cities with this idea in mind, where we have equidistance or near enough equidistance to, you know, goods and services like shops and other things that have similar levels of comfort, in that, you know, you have a certain amount of rooms per people, and all that jazz. I suppose we probably end up with a little less choice. Like, maybe we all have the same light fixtures, I don't know. But maybe not as well. Like, I'm not suggesting that we all have to get the same, you know, I think less equality and more equity, I think, is a good idea, a good rule of thumb for something like this.
So what do you mean by equality and not equity?
Okay, so equality is everybody would get, like, let's say we were doling out food for the week and we had apples, you know, because we're not great farmers to start with, and all we have is apples. And so everyone gets 5 apples, right? That's equality, right? Everyone gets 5 apples, it's fine, every person. Equity might look at something like, oh, maybe some people are allergic to apples, or maybe some people have an apple tree in their backyard and probably don't need anything more from the state. And so it would be these kind of practical elements in equity that we could look at and go, well, look, this family of five needs a bunch of apples. These guys that have an apple tree in their backyard don't need any. And this dude over here is allergic to apples. We need to, like, source some bananas stat, or else he's just going to fall down and die. And so that's kind of equity. I think the equitable approach is probably more practical in terms of applying it to our scenario now, where we don't need to have everybody having the same thing so much as getting everyone up to a basic standard of living, getting everyone up to a basic standard of safety, of food, of, you know, wealth, and then, you know, seeing from there.
So you'd support a universal basic income then?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great idea. I think it's fantastic. And I think it would be real. I think it would work. I think it would change the way that we think about day-to-day living stuff.
Yeah, you know what? I would be thrilled personally to have a universal basic income so I could spend more time, you know, doing the creative and educational projects that I'd want to do, rather than have to work for the man.
Absolutely. That's it. But also, you know, there's, you know, I think one of the biggest fears within a universal basic income is that there's going to be a lot of people that just stop and never work again. I don't think that's how we would go. I think a lot of people are driven to do stuff and to work and to contribute to society. And I think, generally speaking, what we would see is far less unemployment than you're expecting, and maybe far more works that are more communally minded, more you know, investing in other people's and us and our own kind of good.
So you think we'd see more philanthropy and volunteerism?
Yeah, I think so. Because, you know, once we take away the motivation for a huge accumulation of wealth, then other things are given a chance to rise up.
Yeah, you know what? At 18, I would have definitely volunteered at a place rather than worked at a big W. Would have made more sense if money wasn't a factor and I had to work.
Yeah.
So perhaps there's a quid pro quo going on, for the most part, an equitable one rather than an equal one.
And you know what? All we need to do is swallow and get over the little uncomfortableness of saying, I'm going to give up some of my freedoms and some of my rights to get this happening. I think that's the only hurdle here. Once we do that, as long as, you know, the government's on our side, we're fine.
So I think that then we really need to be clear about what we get in exchange for that freedom. Yeah, we're giving up this, but we get this, and so many people benefit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, when looking at something like universal basic income, the idea is to get rid of things like homelessness and get rid of things like you know, people who are starving, people who don't have a place to live. People who don't have enough to feed their children or themselves, Like really basic stuff, like being able to have clean clothes and a dry place to sleep, and sweet stuff like that. I think that is the goal. That's the outcome. And what we need to give up is a little bit of like choice. And we have an overabundance of choice, so I think it's fine.
Isn't there an argument to be made that people are in those dire circumstances because of the choices that they make, and that they've made themselves into a terrible situation through drugs and tomfoolery?
Absolutely. You know, there's a pretty good argument to suggest that. I don't know how accurate or inaccurate that is. I think you could do one of two things. You could either make an argument to say that the vast majority of people who are poor aren't because of what they've done, but because of circumstances, and negate that. I think the more elegant and a nicer argument to make, though, is just to go, I don't care. You know, I don't care if people have failed or made wrong decisions, and that's why they're a junkie living in some shack with 12 other people. I actually don't care why people are stuck. Now, I don't care why people are poor. I don't care whether they've done it intentionally to themselves. Because having tasted a little bit of hard times, not many and not hard, I don't like it. And I don't think anyone would choose it if they had a choice. And so I think, you know, the argument that actually we need to, one of the things we need to do, which is a very capitalist thing, and that is blame the poor for being poor. I think we need to stop doing that, generally speaking. And also then that means that we need to stop praising the rich for being rich, because they didn't do it. You know, you look at anyone who's rich, and 90% of the time it's like, you didn't do anything for this. Even the dudes that have worked very, very hard for their wealth, it's like, yes, but you couldn't have worked so hard that someone else working, you know, in a similar capacity has got nothing. You know, it's,
you know, that reminds me of my favorite Charles Koch quote. Do you know who Charles Koch is?
One of the Koch brothers, right?
Yeah. He big oil magnate in oil.
Right hand of the Lucifer, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. In America, and he has this story where he says how he made his fortune, and he's like, "Well, when I was a child, I grew a tree that grew an apple, and then I sold that apple for two apples, and then I for money, and then I bought two apples, and then I sold that for four apples, and then eight apples, and then 16 apples, and then I inherited $100 billion.
Yeah. It's a great story. I mean, you know, self-awareness in the upper elite is hilarious. I like that.
It does seem to me like there is some self-awareness there, that the money came from somewhere originally, not through.
I don't know whether that amounts to much. My other favorite story on that one is when talking about our good friend, my friend and yours, Donald Trump, where, you know, you go, you know, he took an inheritance of $15 million and he made it $10 million, which is, you know, amazing. You know, and so he's like, you know, the greatest businessman alive is the only one who's lost millions of dollars and still considered wealthy. I don't know how he does it. It's amazing.
You got to admire the greatest showman in history. You know, it's to get to the highest levels of American government through pure showmanship is, I think, the most deeply American thing that you could have.
Yeah, I don't know if showmanship is the right word, but certainly through something. Anyway,
I mean, we could call it like reaching into the deep vein of American fascism. That's always been there.
Yeah.
Did you know that the Klan was a major political party back in like the 1920s and 30s? And they just sort of fell out of vogue when they decided to fight the Nazis instead of inviting them in for a while?
Yeah. They, I mean, if you look too closely at history, you find a bunch of really, like, when you first learn about World War II and you go, oh, yes, the Nazis killed 6 million Jews. And how bad was that? And we fought against it because we're the West and that sort of thing. Anti-Semitism was rife in the Western world right up to that point, and even beyond, really. Let's accept that here, that the anti-Semitism has been one of the prevailing things in Western. And just for those like few years, they were like, no, you can't kill those Jewish people.
Yeah.
The hypocrisy there is crazy amazing that you can pull that off with a straight face.
I'm kind of amazed at anti-Semitism as a thing in the first place, because you do find it everywhere, and you do find it even on campus, because There's like an organization on campus, and I don't want to name them, but they do regularly attack Jews physically. And I'm just amazed that they like.
I just don't understand why. It boggles the mind. It's like we've just chosen, we've gone around and we've gone, okay, that group, yeah, let's just always pick on them. It's schoolyard tomfoolery at its worst. It's absolutely ridiculous. But here we are, you know, this is the world. And how do we deal with it? We get rid of Jeff Bezos, I think that's the conclusion, right?
Yeah, eat the rich.
Yeah, eat the rich.
maybe there's the name of our podcast.
Eat the rich. I think that feels like a pretty valid conclusion based on this discussion. I think definitely what we should do is eat the rich. You know, good source of protein and a lot of wealth redistribution. It's a win-win.
All right. No, I think that we covered the state owns everything fairly well. Do you have any concluding thoughts or?
No, I think eating the rich pretty much puts me where I wanted to be. So yeah.
I mean, like I think we should address the cognitive bias that we currently have, that neither of us are rich, and so we're going to be more inclined for anti-rich solutions to problems.
Yes, okay, yes. But also then I feel like I have a voice from a friend of mine in the back of my head that is pulling me up, who is saying to me right now, we live in Australia in the 21st century. We're both in our own separate homes talking on wireless devices. We are the rich.
That's
probably right. And that's where it gets icky, starts to get icky now, is that, you know, based on global economics, I think actually we might be the rich. So I don't know. I don't know where that leaves the conversation.
Well, I most definitely don't own my house. So
no. Yeah. But I certainly, like, I own more pairs of socks than I could wear in a week. And I feel like that is, as a benchmark, a really depressing but also accurate benchmark about,
yeah,
you know, I have enough food in my house that I can look in the kitchen and go, oh, I've got nothing. I'm going to go buy a takeaway.
Yeah, true. And I've set myself a standard that I want to be able to earn enough money to buy ice cream anytime I want. And I've achieved that life goal.
There. Yeah. If that's not wealth, I don't know what is.
It's like, excuse me, I'm going to go and buy an ice cream sandwich.